Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Sorry I'm late. Let's get started. The subject is infrastructure this afternoon. Andrew, do you have anything to open with?
An intro that it's both infrastructure from 2 to 4, and then we have technology requests from 4 to 4:30, although I suspect that will go a little long. You have other sort of miscellaneous time up until 5. So that's the plan for today.
Okay. So who's up first? Asset management report. Susan's going to do that. Thank you.
So good afternoon. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And we have a whole crew up here today of other Bureau directors. David Chaff with the Water Bureau. Dean, who will be here soon. Mike Abade from Parks, Leah Treat from Transportation, Fred Miller from OMF, and Chief Jansen from the Fire Bureau. If you look in your binder, you will see a report called the 2013 Citywide Assets Report and a brief overview, which looks like this. For several years, planning and sustainability has helped to facilitate and kind of coordinate the citywide asset management efforts. We also do the citywide systems report that's required by state. So we work with the bureaus to compile the data into one report. And several years ago, City Council started this process with the idea that each bureau does have a unique mission, but each bureau also very much faces similar decisions in terms of having to protect and make sure that our assets are in safe and in good condition. So they asked for someone to bring it all together and run a report, and that was the Planning Bureau. So I will walk through a quick update on the status. It also gives you an opportunity to kind of step out of your own sort of silo of your own bureaus and look at all of the assets of the city at one time. So if you look at the slides there, the second slide, to start off with, our total assets have a replacement value of about $30 billion. As you can see, about two-thirds of that is for water, sewer, and stormwater assets. About a quarter is for transportation and streetlights, and a very small percentage is for all of our buildings, city hall, police, fire stations, and for parks. The next chart.
And those are parks improvements, not parks land.
Right? It's not the land. It's for all of the improvements on the land. Correct. The next slide talks about the asset condition. You can see that all of the bureaus have kind of a range of conditions from very good to very poor. If you look at the overall $30+ billion number, about 60% of all of our assets are in good to very good condition. About 20% are in the okay fair kind of range, and about 20% are in the poor or very poor condition. Just like any asset that you own, it's okay to slide into the fair kind of condition occasionally, but it can be outright dangerous, especially for many of our assets, and very costly for us if we let things fall into poor condition. I think I heard Commissioner Novick say one time, he once compared this to dental health. I don't know if you remember this, but he said something like you can brush and maintain your teeth, or you can get a root canal. And so brushing and flossing is tedious, but it's cheap. And a root canal is expensive and painful. And I think overall the bureaus do a good job of trying to stay away from the big, messy, painful sort of events, but every once in a while they do happen. Some bureaus are better able to do this than others, and obviously some have more resources than others. The Water Bureau has very little infrastructure that is in poor or very poor categories, so that would be the red and the orange on the graph there. Transportation, on the other hand, as we know, needs a little bit more help. Turning to the next slide, this talks about risk. So risk really has two key components, and the first is what is the consequence of failure? So if a structure or building fails, will a lot of people get hurt? Will the environment be degraded in a significant way? Are there major health risks? And then the second component of risk is what is the likelihood of failure? So what is the probability that something is actually going to break down or fail completely? So obviously on this graph, we want to be down in the left-hand bottom corner as much as possible. So to do this, the bureaus really spend money in what I'd call a very proactive maintenance mode. And they focus on things that, if they break, it could be a big disaster, but they also focus on those things that wear out quickly and are likely to break a lot. So the first time we put up this slide, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, this was an hour conversation where council was trying to get to this point of understanding that you don't just invest in the big things that have big consequences, because the little things that are constantly breaking out, you need to make sure that you repair those things too. Next slide is about the funding gap. So we've estimated the funding gap as of 2013 at about $280 million. What this gap really represents is that it's the amount needed to meet the various bureaus' service level targets. And service level targets are like benchmarks or goals. So an example would be for parks, when target is having a park or green space for all Portland residents within a half-mile walk. For transportation, it's a goal that 80% of arterial and collector streets are in fair or better condition. For water, it's being in compliance for state and federal water quality regulations. And for BES, an example is that there's no spills into the street or basements for up to a 25-year storm event. So the funding gap in the bar graph there really looks at three things. It looks at repair, rehab, and replacement. It also looks at mandated or required investments and also at capacity. And as you can see in the graph, they all look at repair, rehab, and replacement. And that's the blue color there. But there are also some differences at how the different bureaus look at some of the maintenance and some of the asset management. For example, BES also shows their capacity needs. And capacity means what do they need to build to serve future demand. Water has generally funded all their mandates, but you can talk to David more about that. And so what's shown there is for repair and replacement. And for this graph, Parks shows what it needs to serve both their current and future demands. So they're putting in their capacity needs also. Transportation is a different story. The transportation bar is $150 plus million just for repair, rehab, and replacement. They haven't added in any capacity needs, which would obviously be much higher. The bar would probably go off the top of the page. And finally, the bar that's labeled civic. This includes all the buildings that we own and that OMF manages. But this bar graph doesn't include some investments because this was a year ago and we didn't really quite talk about this at this time, the new investments potential for the Portland building. So the gap here is $280 million, but realistically it could be as high as $400 or $500 million if you included the capacity needs for transportation, the Portland building, and potentially seismic, additional seismic investments that not all the bureaus have put in. So it's a good snapshot, but it's not 100% complete snapshot of all of the asset management needs. So the run of show here will be, that's sort of the broad picture. If you have questions about that, we can do those now. Otherwise, we're going to walk through water and BES. We'll talk briefly because they've had a lot of time with you already in the past week or two, is my understanding. Parks, transportation, OMF, and fire, then we'll follow, and then we'll wrap up with a recommendation.
Susan at the outset here. Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is David Schaff. I'm the director of the Water Bureau. On this slide, we'll talk about the fact that Portland ratepayers own approximately $7.6 billion in assets. We have over 2,000 miles of pipe, 12 million feet, stretches from here to St. Louis, and we serve a quarter of the state's population, about 900,000 people. Most of what you know about us is underground, and it's invisible, or it's locked away somewhere where you don't see it, like up at the Bull Run watershed. All of our pipes eventually going to have to be replaced, but we're trying to be as selective as possible about what pipes we do replace. So we're focusing on pipes to critical facilities, such as hospitals, pipes that have major consequences if they were to fail, or pipes that have a high risk of failure. Next slide. So we have hundreds of pipes that cross over and under our major highways and railroad lines. It's standard practice now to encase those pipes, and that means that we put the pipe with the water inside a bigger pipe so that if the pipe with the water breaks, the water won't undermine the railroad, the highway. And the pipe here, as an example, was under the Union Pacific Railroad. It also happened to be very shallow, so the vibration from the trains could cause failure of that pipe. It was also made of ductile iron, which is more brittle, and we've encased the new pipe, and we've made it deeper, and we've used ductile iron pipe, which is much more flexible, longer-lasting pipe. Next slide. Well, so what are our challenges? One, you know, we're obviously a highly regulated utility. We continue to see increased state and federal regulations and requirements, and there is no money coming from state or federal coffers to implement those mandates. As many of us are beginning to learn, we're in a potentially active earthquake risk zone. The map in the middle slide, this slide, reflects the high hazard earthquake risks that we have here in Portland. And you can see, it's kind of hard to see in that particular slide, but we have some significant risks in our area. And finally, we have a 120-year-old system. We see about 200 main breaks a year. So what we've done is we've forecast pipe replacement rates for the majority of pipes that we have that we refer to as less consequential. An example of that is probably the pipe that goes in front of all of our homes. As a general rule, what we do is we look at those, and the replacement is based on waiting for either multiple leaks to or breaks to occur. And once the continued cost to repair exceeds the cost to replace, we'll go in and replace that. It's typically cheaper, to repair than it is to replace pipes. So we're keeping up with these needs, but as our system ages, the increase of pipe rates breaks will increase in the future. Now, there's another group of pipes that which is much more important to consider, and that's what we refer to as our high-consequence pipes. The ones that I mentioned earlier, pipe crossings under highways, waterways, railroads, pipes that are a primary supply to a major customer like OHSU. If possible, we want to avoid the impacts of these pipes failing by replacing them before they fail. Efforts are ongoing now to identify the worst of these, but frankly, we believe we're investing too little in these high-consequence pipe replacements. Dean?
Good afternoon. I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director, and you see the similar slides to what David just talked about. For Environmental Services, we have $13 billion worth of assets. We have two wastewater treatment plants, one in North Portland on Columbia Boulevard is the largest publicly owned treatment works in the state of Oregon. We have over 2,000 miles of pipe, 97 pumping stations, and I'll take the next slide, please. So this is an example of a project that we are doing to deal with our aging infrastructure. This map shows the Selwood-Moreland neighborhood. It's a $7.5 million project that's just about to get started this year, dealing with addressing 80 to 100-year-old sewer lines mixed throughout the neighborhoods. And as David suggested, we use the same approach. We go after the worst of the worst and leave alone that which is still functioning. But this is representative of over $200 million worth of sewer rehab work that we either are doing now or are about to do throughout much of Portland. Next slide, please. For Environmental Services, we are also a very highly regulated utility. We're both a stormwater utility and a wastewater utility. So we answer to state and federal regulators just as the Water Bureau does. Our biggest threats, I think, are coming from new regulations, new laws dealing with things such as exotic toxics and other things that are found in wastewater that conventional wastewater treatment process does not remove. We also, of course, are dealing with aging infrastructure. A third of our collection system is more than 80 years old, so it is reaching the end of its useful life. So I'll turn it over now to Mike Abate of Parks.
Thank you, Dean. Again, Mike Abate, Portland Parks and Recreation Director. You know, Portland Parks and Recreation has responsibility for 11,500 acres across the city. 209 developed parks and plus natural areas. One of the things that's interesting about parks is the diversity of our assets. They run a spectrum from trees to community centers. In ages, they run from the 1870s to things we just opened in the last 6 months to a year. And the conditions range from excellent, particularly for those things that have recently opened, to closed. We have a number of closed facilities and buildings. The three challenges that I'm going to focus on today are really directly related to how do we provide the services. Number one is the day-to-day operations and maintenance. We have maintenance. When we talk about maintenance in parks, it refers to day-to-day activities, then scheduled activities that might have come on a recurring basis, and then major repairs and rehabilitation. So we'll talk about the day-to-day. I want to talk a second challenge that's facing us is level of service, and then the stewardship of existing assets or our maintenance of those assets. So the first challenge I want to talk about is the level of service. As you all know, how important access to nature and to play is for Portlanders, especially in an urban environment that's becoming more and more dense. And there's deep inequities in our Portland Park system. We have about 53,000 households that are not within walking distance of a neighborhood park or natural area.
That's again, I'm sorry.
Say 53,000 households. This slide is an enlargement of the I-84, I-205 junction, just to orient you. One of the key areas, as even Susan said, a key metric for us is having a park within a half a mile of all households. Areas that are in dark green on the slide are existing parks, developed parks. The shaded areas are the influence areas or the capture areas, if you will, of those individual parks. Areas you see in white would be what we consider gaps in the system. Recently, Commissioner Fritz announced that we're going to build two new parks. So in the lower right, you'll see Gateway Park and Plaza, and in the upper right, the beach property. The red lines indicate the capture areas for those two proposed new parks, and as you can see, they're strategically located and make some huge differences. You'll also see that there's two other projects that are currently underway, Thomas Cully, a property at the upper part of the slide, and just to the west of that, Werben property. And you can see how important those parks are going to be to filling gaps in the system.
But let's just say 1,800 homes for the two East Portland parks, which does chip away at the 53,000, but it shows that we still have a long way to go.
Absolutely, yes. And I think with all four of those, it's about 3,600 households will be served by those four areas. Okay, next slide, please. So if one challenge is the level of service, the other challenge is risk. So it's a reminiscent of the slide that Susan showed a few minutes ago. And for us, this is looking at playgrounds. So the horizontal axis is the consequence. If something fails, how serious is the consequence? The higher the number or the further to the right, the greater the consequence. Up in the vertical scale is the likelihood of that occurring. So you can see that from a risk management point of view, we would like to have all of our facilities down in the lower right. This is just a snapshot on playgrounds. And you can see that a couple of labels. There's upper right, there's a Cooch Park. High likelihood of failure and high consequence of failure as well. Some of these parks we will be renovating and will move down to the lower column. So the goal in risk management is move all your assets down to the lower right as quickly as you can. Next slide.
Mike, I know I sound like a broken record, but I can't read the handout on that kind of stuff. So can we just go back to the old admonition that if we can pump these things up just so they're more legible, because it's probably more legible up there, but this one is, I defy anyone to be able to decode this one. It looks like important information. So
I apologize.
We'll kill an extra tree next time if we can.
Okay, we'll do it.
So I just had another question related to this slide in particular. So you say Cooch Park is a very high risk and also high consequence, and this is just for the playground, right?
Yes, it's just, and it's just for particular pieces of the playground. If you know Cooch Park, they're
I live at Cooch Park.
Okay, so we're talking about we're talking about the wood. You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, no, I know.
No, the timber structure is the one that we're talking about. And as a matter of fact, over the last couple of years, we have actually removed some pieces. You wouldn't necessarily see them or notice it now, but we've removed some pieces because of failure of the wood rot.
And that playground was very recently renovated, wasn't it? I mean, wasn't it just a few years ago when they went in and redid that? I don't know. I think maybe I lose track of time. But
there have been some repairs over the years.
It was just repaired.
The challenge for us with wood play structures is they have a very, very short life. And it's a very loved play area, but it's one that really needs to be replaced.
Okay. Thank you.
Next slide. So now I'd like to talk just shortly about our response to those conditions, if you will, like in the previous slide. Taking care of our assets to provide those desired levels of service. I mentioned the gaps, and we know about where we need new facilities, but if old facilities close down, we actually can create new gaps if a park is not functioning fully. So it's really important for us that that we think about taking care of those assets long term. So those three parts, again, sufficient O&M funding on a day-to-day basis are critical, the major maintenance funding for large and predictable rehab and replacement. And then if you look at our system over time, there's been periodic infusions through bonds primarily for major renovations and selected new development. So this slide of Selwood Pool is a good example. Selwood Pool is open. It's maintained and daily operates in the summer, and so the day-to-day O&M is taken care of. Replastering the pool, on the other hand, is something that happens on a regular basis, maybe every 8 to 10 years, and might cost $100,000. And that would fit into the category of a major maintenance kind of project. But the roof and the structure, the substructure of the roof and the building itself also is in need of major rehabilitation. And that's something that would be in the area of $1 million or $2 million. And those are the kinds of things that traditionally have been funded through large infusions of cash, through bond measures or levies. Okay, now next slide, please. Talk a little bit about our capital program. The capital improvement plan that Parks has for addressing park growth, closing gaps in our levels of service, totals about $480 million over the next 10 years. Those are the gaps. The funding gap for taking care of existing assets continues to grow. It's now estimated at 365. So you end up at about the bar chart that Susan had, about $840 million, add that together, filling the gaps and taking care of what we have. Often, more sources of funding are available for the development of new parks. For example, the two new parks all the new parks work that has been announced in the last few months has been funded through system development charges that come as a direct consequence of added development. What's really key to remember about system development charges is they can only be used to expand the capacity of the existing system. They can't be used to renovate or take care of what you already have. So some of the challenges that we have in our capital program, we have I think close to 2,000 items on our CIP plan. The vast majority of those are unfunded. More than half of our playgrounds need to be replaced in the next decade. And as we move to more complicated kinds of play equipment and play environments, then the replacement cycle accelerates. So the cost of the major maintenance side of things increases. We've got several new achievements that I'd like to mention to take care of some things. We've got some new community gardens at Grant, Mount Tabor, and Helen's View. Done a wonderful job at Oaks Bluff or Oaks Bottom with the Bluff Trail restoration, replastered the Columbia Pool, And then we've made several E-205 improvements at Cherry Park and Midland Park. Underway currently, South Waterfront Greenway Trail. Thank you, Council, for approving that continuation and completion of that project recently. Northeast 52nd and Alberta is a new park in the Cully neighborhood. It was in one of the, it was in that slide of gaps. I think it said Werben property on that. And Thomas Cully Park, moving forward on those. And also we're in process with some facility improvements for maintenance at Delta Park and Chimney Park.
Mike, why, yes. What's the premium, what is the explanation for the premium on O&M for a fully accessible playground? Why does it cost you more to do O&M on Harper's Playground than another playground?
I'd say three primary factors. Water, sand, and rubber. Water play structures or play environments create issues. So fountains are more complicated to expensive to operate than, for example, a static piece of play equipment. Water and sand, which Harper's Playground has. Sand is a fantastic environment. Kids love it. Sand gets everywhere. People slip on it. Sand wears down surfaces, gets caught into moving parts, and then you have to do repairs more often. And then finally, it's the rubber surfacing. That surfacing that you see at Harper's Playground that you can walk right across, you can roll right across, has about a 10-year lifespan, and particularly in places, I'll say like in key wear areas, underneath swings, for example, those get scuffed up very quickly. In traditional play environments, we use bark chips that are graded and compacted to a particular level to be considered ADA accessible. When chips get kicked out, we bring in some more chips and fill it. When the rubber gets worn out in those surfaces, we have to replace a big piece of rubber. It takes specialized contractors. Thank you. Maybe more detail than you needed, but. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So now let me touch on the decision packages that we have included in the requested budget. The other day, I told you a little bit about our strategic plan and its focus on equity. Another major theme has to do with asset management. And so these packages I'm going to describe today really are focused on closing gaps in management practices and asset management practices that are essential to us making sure that our park system is in better shape years from now than it is today. And then secondly, the themes relate to improving our condition assessment, our identifying of risk, and our funding strategies for capital improvements. I would like to mention, too, that the city auditor recently completed a report and an audit directly on parks maintenance practices. So many of these packages are a direct result of items that the auditor's office pointed out for improved service, and we'd like to move with those. So the first package in your list is PK01, workplace improvements at Mount Tabor Yard. The request there is slightly over $2 million. As you know, Mount Tabor is our single biggest work site out within the park system. Nearly 100 people work out of Mount Tabor. It's centralized. All of our mowers come from there, our carpenters, our electricians. It is our oldest facility, and a master plan has been completed for the Mount Tabor Yard. The master plan showed that, and this was 7-8 years ago, it would require about $45 million to rebuild Mount Tabor Yard. We understand that that's a very large number, and so what we have done is to identify a $3 million package of improvements at Mount Tabor that would deal with the most critical health and safety and workplace improvement issues that need to be addressed. Of that $3 million, we have been saving away $1 million towards that, so we have $1 million towards that $3 million, hence the $2 million ask. So as I mentioned, this would provide capital funds to correct the most urgent hazards, that potentially pose employee health and safety risks, would increase efficiency and effectiveness in our asset management system, and it would improve our ability to perform an effective role in the case of citywide emergencies. Second package is PK04, Parks and Natural Area Maintenance Enhancements. This gets to, remember, I sort of described this three-legged chair of day-to-day operations and maintenance, periodic major maintenance, and then capital infusions on a maybe decade level. This really is looking at cuts that Parks has retained or sustained over the past 2 years or 3 years in actual maintenance on the ground, day-to-day maintenance. So this package would restore six park technicians, utility workers, botanical specialists, and technicians with their associated M&S. It would also add a three positions to be responsible for a new park inspection program to improve our customer service and make us really bring us into line with best practices that are in park systems, and that is to have dedicated staff that are out looking at parks, evaluating their performance, evaluating the maintenance. Believe that for us to even get to the point to ask the public for additional funds for facilities, we need to demonstrate, and I think the auditor's report was right on here, that we are doing the absolute best level of service as that we can. The next package is PK07, Asset Management Implementation. To this point, asset management in parks has been something we have reallocated existing resources to accomplish. As a matter of fact, we have moved people from some positions to other positions to focus on asset management. However, we understand that from our brother and sister bureaus, as a matter of fact, who are the highest performers in asset management, we have to have dedicated people that are inspectors, that are reporters, that analyze risks. And so PK07, $260,000, would create a central services asset management supervisor, inspector, and a management analyst. PK08 is called a major maintenance. And this really is a result of the fact that for the past number of years, we have had a total of about $1 million to use Portland Parks for asset for major maintenance. One project can wipe that out. The council made a wonderful decision last year to retire some debt. That debt was costing us about $300,000 a year in major maintenance funds. That is now being restored because of that debt that was retired by council action. However, even $1 million a year when you're facing $480 million shortfall doesn't get you very far. And so this package is $500,000 to go to reducing risk of asset failure and, frankly, to replace assets that are about to fail or pose a safety concern. And then the last one is PK10. This is operations maintenance from acquisition and improvements. This is the O&M that, by council policy, is requested as a normal course of operations when we bring a new park online. So, finally, if I can close, last slide. Funding for Portland Parks is complex, and it's getting more so by the day. And in order to support this large and diverse system of assets, a long-term funding source is needed. An effective and plausible solution will be a likely combination of various sources and revenue streams. It'll probably not be a single, simple system. To fund those three things, day-to-day operations, adequate and continuing O&M funding is the foundation of new parks. Just to mention that since 2008 is when the council adopted the policy that when they approved a new park, we were required to provide an estimate of the maintenance, and that got evaluated along with the proceeding of the park. Since 2008, 14 parks, the newest developed parks, have received this dedicated O&M funding. That means that, that's 14, 195 developed parks existed prior to that policy being in place. So the second thing after day-to-day operations is stewardship. We need an appropriately sized major maintenance fund that could address rehabilitation and renovation work beyond the scope of day-to-day O&M, particularly the known and predictable recurring investments that are needed in pools, community centers, and parks to keep them open. And finally, capital improvements. As I mentioned, historically, voters have supported Portland Parks and Recreation every 8, 9, 10 years with a large funding boost that can be used both to build new parks and to address major capital needs like, so for example, Selwood Pool. So we would welcome the opportunity to work with the CBO this year to explore options for a renewed and restructured general fund allocation towards major maintenance obligations as one component of of a more complete solution. So apologize for the length of that.
Questions?
Mike, I have a question. My understanding is in the last term of Bloomberg administration, they embarked on about a $3 billion capital spending program for parks. And one of the things they did is they like the new Brooklyn Bridge Park, they acquired some dirt, but they mandated there be some development on the edge of the dirt, and used the proceeds from the development to cover the operating costs. And that obviously is just a reaction to the fact that you're looking for a new model for how to cover things, and you buy more land than you need for the park, and you develop it but keep the proceeds. I know that you've really pushed the envelope on public-private partnerships, but are there, in addition to levies and bond measures and public-private partnerships, are there some new models out there for how we as a council can creatively create streams of revenue to cover O&M, for example, through things like leveraging development and parks in certain areas?
That's a great question. I think we're constantly looking for those new ideas, and I would say that there are proposals that we're considering right now, working with partners, talking about Holiday Park, for example, how to operate that and how to activate that space in a creative way. But in terms of new development, there are a couple of development proposals where developers have come to us and say, hey, we'd like to look at, are there some options? And we've been happy to have those conversations. I think that for us, at the bottom line is that the park has to be publicly accessible and recognize as a public asset. That's a key feature. Some people would like to call it a park and get credit for building a park, but exclude use or restrict use. And so that's kind of one of the sort of first principles we put down. Is we'll talk about all sort of creative options for funding this. Bottom line is the public has to see it as a place that's available to them.
But, I mean, given a value in Portland of parks as public places and a wariness of commercialization, which we heard earlier today, given what you see in park agencies around the country, thinking about the restaurant in Central Park,
right.
Where are we on that continuum, and is there room for movement, in your opinion?
I think maybe a poster child might be Millennium Park in Chicago, which is at one far end of the spectrum where it was funded entirely with private dollars and is actually operated not by the Parks Department of Chicago, but publicly accessible, but subject to all a whole host of rules and things that are not necessarily general park rules. That's one end of the spectrum. Some people are considering that. That something of that scale, or not even that scale, but that type hasn't been proposed to us yet. I think we would bring a concern that we would want it to be maintained again in the public realm. I think one of the challenges facing park bureaus around the country is that as we've pushed public-private partnerships, we have in fact reduced the access to parks in some ways. As we, even Portland Parks and Recreation, have been very successful in generating, doing fundraising and those kinds of things, the public benefit has been slightly reduced. We charge for things. We close things. There are admission fees. All of those are really related to a direction from council from years ago to have a certain cost recovery model. And so I think one of the challenges to wrestle with is what is the level of service that we want to provide to our citizens and to all of our citizens, regardless of their ability to pay. And we have become dependent, in particular in our community centers, on fees. We have scholarships, but I fear, when I look out long-term, that we end up not just the privatization, it's not that, it's still public, but that we have greatly restricted use of parks because we require monetary exchange, pay as you go.
Yeah. First of all, I should preface this by saying that I'm a big fan of our park system and a frequent user of Gabriel Park, both the summer and winter dog park specifically. And I applaud the commissioner in charge's effort and your efforts to extend parks facilities to areas that don't have them. I have, as you know, been a bit concerned about the practice of adding in O&M costs for new parks outside the regular budget process. And the CBO made some observations relating to parks this year that I think bear repeating. They said that currently decisions regarding O&M for new parks, that is, are made at the time contract ordinances are brought to council. This results in a fragmented decision-making process. In cut years, these CAL adjustments increase the cut amount for all general fund bureaus, while in years where no cuts are necessary, these increases preempt other requests. And they proposed that in addition to showing the aggregate O&M impacts of plans, the Bureau should submit a decision package each year for all projects that are expected to be contracted in the upcoming year. This would allow City Council to discuss all projects, their anticipated O&M funding, before the contract comes before them, and would allow them to have the discussion in an overall budget context. So I wanted to pose the question to the Commissioner in charge and Director of my colleagues as to whether they would agree with CBO's suggestion.
I don't think it's feasible.
And just in the time that I've been Parks Commissioner, Commissioner Fish or the Mayor, when he was proposing the Parks budget last year, didn't know that we were going to do the Gateway Plaza and Beach. Just today, we purchased a new property that came on the market in the last several weeks, and I didn't know that we were going to do that. So there's, depending on the project, there's different operations and maintenance for it. So that's why we have the decision package of PK10, which is everything that's come in over the past year, and that should certainly, I think, be submitted to the budget process early. I know that part of your concern is not when we get the first number, whenever that was in December, that we should have had the previous years built into that. But I just don't know how I would be able to guess that.
Could I ask CBO to weigh in on the feasibility?
Hi, Claudio Campuzano, City Budget Office. I think that you're absolutely right. Estimating what the O&M will be on projects that haven't been identified yet is very difficult, but estimating O&M for the average O&M based on the funding availability. So, for example, with SDCs, which system development charges, which we've developed a considerable balance and which we're using for these projects, we know that we have $20-25 million of SDCs available and that over the next several years we'll be identifying projects. So I think that to the degree that there's capacity in the Bureau to actually be doing these projects, we can come up with at least a reasonable sum as a plug for next year, and then also looking at the five-year forecast, you can get a general sense of what that O&M impact is going to be. I think the Bureau right now estimates about $2.5 million of O&M over the next 5 years, given the SDC availability. So, I think that getting a precise figure can be very challenging if we haven't identified the projects yet, but getting a general idea and making sure that we start to plan for that is important.
Well, certainly for the long projects, you know, we know when Gates and the beach property will, the Gateway, sorry, and the beach property will be coming online, so we can certainly forecast that into that particular year's budget. So we could do better, I guess, is the answer to your question, but I don't think we could nail it down just because of the nature of being opportunistic about what we do and including community input about what we do.
But if Bill wrote a big enough check, we might call it Gates Park. Just kidding, just kidding.
I think
should we have a process for that?
I think as Claudio pointed out, you know, the goal here is to make sure that we have something planned, you know, for these expansions, whether it's the exact number. You know, it will be adjusted as we learn, you know, more as we get closer. But if we have, you know, $500,000 built in for these planned expansions and the costs end up being $600,000 or $700,000, it's a lot better to have already planned for the five than it is to have planned for
six. Andrew, let's take today's example. Council voted to support the acquisition of property, but the commissioner in charge announced we'd be essentially mothballing it because we don't have the money to do a master plan of developing. So I believe the forecast O&M was $17,000. So that's not an amount which is going to have much of an impact on our budget discussions. It's those areas, it's those instances where we are actually moving forward with master plans and development that the real O&M comes in, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's correct.
And short of repealing the 2008 ordinance, the council could highlight and these acquisitions, you know, we can have these discussions about, it is, I guess, theoretically possible we could say, we're going to delay doing some work because we can't budget for the O&M, for example, because it is much less expensive to acquire and put the fence up and mothball it. Problem, of course, in East Portland is that it was a Pyrrhic victory all these years. So the last 20 years, we spent more money in East Portland acquiring property than any other place in the city, except it didn't quite feel like a win for a lot of the families there because it had these were properties with fences around them. But we do have the ability to calibrate this a little bit depending on whether we develop a park versus just acquire a park.
And I agree, and I appreciate the CBO's recommendations and want to have some more discussion with you about how we can modify the process next year. The other, and going back to the question, I think somebody else's question, isn't there still in the parks budget an expectation that we sell $400,000 worth of land every year?
Yes, that's a revenue that was built in 2 budget cycles ago.
So that's of concern to me. Part of the reason that we don't do the New York model and develop on the edges is many of these parcels are pretty darn small in the first place, but they're all that we have. So I don't want to be required or indeed basically down $400,000 because we're supposed to be selling off parkland according to that policy.
By the way, as I understand the Brooklyn model, and Mike's the expert, but my understanding is they figured out they wanted a park of 10 acres. They found the capital spending to acquire 12 acres of land, gave parks the extra 2, allowed them to be the owner for purposes of entering into negotiation with a developer. Developer put slaps a big building in, that revenue comes to parks. It wasn't an intrusion into a public space. It was built into the model that they would acquire more space than necessary and just dedicate the revenue source from that, which is a little different than the fear you have, Mike, about the encroachments, because it was a bit of a fiction. It was added in to give that revenue source. It wasn't an intrusion into an existing public space.
And it is like our SDC program itself. We do not dedicate SDCs to a particular piece of ground. A project will generate SDCs, and those can be spent in the central city and a portion outside the central city, but in that model in particular, my recollection is that those funds were then dedicated to developing that particular part.
Right.
I will note that there's a part of me that would like to try to take advantage of the precedence granted to maintenance for new parks by redesignating some other assets as parks. We could have long, narrow new parks with names like Burnside and Division.
Oh, you are getting $100,000 in operations and maintenance for the West Side Emergency Center because it's all facilities. So it's not just, I thought it was just parks, and it's not. It's all new facilities get dedicated operations and maintenance. built in.
And actually, I do want to clarify that. What the policy says is that council needs to have that conversation, should have that conversation up front, and that we should provide operations and maintenance funding for new assets. It doesn't necessarily require new funding for those assets. It requires that we identify the O&M. So a choice, and again, it would be on a case-by-case basis, could also be to say, we're going to take away from an existing asset or an existing program in order to fund a new one. So again, this is very unpopular, but I think that's my job sometimes to do that. An option for parks, probably not a good one, would be to open an East Portland park and shut down a West Side park. Right, and you could then change the system. You're not expanding the system. You're just moving funds from one area of town to another. Again, so I just want to say that the O&M, and that would perfectly comply with the city's O&M policy, which is that we're opening a new asset, we're providing the O&M for it. But that may, again, not be the choice that people want to make. But
well, that's a good point. And if your point too, Commissioner Novick, is well made, that we are not going to have enough money in the general fund to do the operations and maintenance. If you budget about 10% for any new asset, and if we was to do, say, a $200 million bond measure, that would be another $20 million in operations and maintenance. We just don't have it. So we need to have a serious conversation with our community about what do we want to buy and how do we want to pay for it. We also need to recognize that it's not fair to just maintain what we have, because those who have not never get anything.
I should note that we have something of the same issue in transportation, where, as we know, there are streets that are not paved, and we don't have the money to maintain the existing streets. And we're in a situation where if we thought we were never going to get any more money, we might have to decide, well, if we're going to pave an unpaved street, we'd have to decide which of our existing streets to go to gravel.
Mm-hmm. You know, Andrew has job security, so he can say the unpopular things, as he just did.
Is that a promise?
My recollection of the 2008 policy wasn't that it was intended to give us the option to cannibalize the system, but it was to catch up prospectively and to match new acquisitions with new funding. So there might be an interpretation that gets us to that scenario, but my recollection was it was to say, and by the way, had the transportation commissioner at the time put a similar ordinance forward, the same principle. We were not going to close a street in order to have the O&M for a new street. It was intended to at least match some new asset with the O&M. That's my recollection.
So if I can return just momentarily before we move on to your ad requests. The Tabor Yard request, CBO recommended a portion of that. Has that already been, in effect, recalibrated for however much of the maintenance operation you can still move to the Holgate, the newer Holgate facility? I
mean, Flavelle,
sorry. Yeah. Is that fully utilized?
Flavelle is fully utilized by both Parks Maintenance staff and City Nature Maintenance staff, so there isn't capacity in that.
We don't have any remaining land there that we could, in other words, is it less expensive to decentralize a little bit and put additional facilities at Flavelle and or the Sears site, to the extent that the Sears site can accommodate a little bit of maintenance?
We have looked at Sears, toured it, and we have several ideas. We evaluated, for example, even urban forestry moving from Delta Park to Sears. For functional reasons, that didn't make sense. But we do have City Nature staff right now that are in very substandard conditions on the west side that would be very good candidates for the Sears facility. So there, Mr. Mayor, I'd say it's detached from Mount Tabor. There isn't a whole lot of overlap, but we have maintenance. We have needs for our maintenance staff all over the city.
Okay. So we get to solve some of those problems at the Sears site, but not these problems.
Not the Mount Tabor problems, right?
Mike, just can you remind us if PK1 is the Mount Tabor, what's the ranking you gave to converting some of the seasonals?
Commissioner, can I get back to you on that?
I was two.
Don't think, huh? I have that.
It was two?
It was two or three.
Yeah.
But they're sort of different. I mean, they're like, so if
one is one time and one is ongoing.
Yeah.
The Mount Tabor is one time funding.
Right.
They're both, I'll be honest with you, they're both for our employees. I mean, they both benefit the system and recognize challenges that our employees are facing.
But what, if you had to do a force ranking, you've already done a ranking. But
I think Mount Tabor is if you're asking for one-time funding, I would say Mount Tabor would be our highest priority.
And for ongoing, it was the seasonals. And,
yes.
And we get 32 full-time positions for the $1 million with the seasonals to permanent. We get, was it 9 or 10 with the $1 million that's requested in this package for the natural areas maintenance?
Right, because those are new positions rather than converting. The seasonals are, we're just paying the delta between the seasonal wage and the benefits and the permanent.
Regarding, and Claudio may expand on this, I just took on the Mount Tabor recommendation, one of the things we recommended was $850,000, which is scaled back and only, I think, due to general fund, you know, restraints. But we do recommend that $500,000 of that be ongoing in the first year that the Parks Bureau use it on Mount Tabor, and in every year beyond that, it goes into their major maintenance to, again, boost that, as Mike talked about, from the $1.2 million to $1.7 million. So you get a little bit of a it sort of offsets that cost in the first year because $500,000 is ongoing. So it's a portion of each.
All right. Any more questions for Mike before we move on to...
I just wanted to say, usually this part of the budget hearings make me very agitated and nervous because I'm pushing for East Portland and to have inclusion, you know, and then to hear about all the problems with existing structures, I feel kind of uncomfortable. This time, knowing that you're adding two parks in an area that really needs them, in spite of the fact that you know that it will cause problems, shows a lot of dedication to equity. And I especially thank Amanda Fritz for finding that money and the rest of the council for supporting her. I think it's really wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kay. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Mayor, before we move on, I had some questions on the Water Bureau and BES. Are we going to go back to those?
Let's go ahead and do that now before we move on. Yeah.
Well, the first one wasn't so much a question as a commendation for the Water Bureau. I noticed in the CBO analysis that for praising you for your transparency. And I just wanted to read this because I know that there's some concern in the community about whether we really know what's going on in the Water Bureau. And they said that they find the Water Bureau provides sufficient access to Bureau finances and related information the public would benefit if other bureaus provided a similar degree of transparency. Included in the Bureau's requested budget are extensive details on several aspects of the budget, details that are uncommon compared with details provided by other bureaus. And then some of those examples are listing all of the professional services contracts, very detailed training and travel expenditures, and all major equipment expenses. So I thank you and the commissioner in charge for providing that information. It's going to make the analysis by the Citizens Utility Board and others, and it certainly has helped the CBO. So thank you for that. Then I had some questions for hard with this mic. Thank you so much. All right. So on the environmental services, I appreciate, again, the commissioner in charge trying to keep the rates as low as possible. I'm wondering about the capital, the debt service coverage, and the analysis says that paying close attention to the CIP during the budget is crucial, and that we should consider alternative methods of aligning this capital improvement plans and the rate increase approval. So to the city budget office, could you elaborate more on your alternatives to current practices as highlighted in your report?
Yeah, I'll let Ryan talk a little bit about that. I thought it was for both water and BES, was it?
This is for BES.
Oh, I'm sorry, for BES, yeah. And actually, we wrote some similar things as well for both of the utilities. But yeah, we can bring Tess up here as well. I mean, in general, I think what we were trying to highlight for both the utilities is the interrelationship between the debt financing ordinances that council gets, you know, routinely, and then the rate increases as well. And in a lot of cases, when you're adopting, you know, a bond finance, you're selling bonds to finance these capital projects, it's anticipating certain rate increases in the future. And I think one of the things that we as a city, and I say that sort of globally, you know, CBO providing the information, the Bureau providing the information, and Council making sure that they're paying attention, you know, to the ordinances before them, so that we're aware of that rate impact in the future. Because I think the Bureaus, you know, have felt a little bit that a lot of these capital projects have been approved and a lot of the debt financing has been approved. When they then are asked to make rate reductions, it has to be on the operating side. And so I think what we are trying to put forward was really a brainstorm. It wasn't so much very specific things as just here are a few different options you could take that would sort of, you know, change that and make it a little bit more transparent. Because a lot of those debt financing, a lot of the payments on the debt don't actually become due for another fiscal year.